The Trail of Tears, I had no idea. It is America's biggest shame that it is that the Trail of Tears and the reasons for it, the outcome of it, and what happened to these Indians who were removed from a homeland to the IT or the Indian Territory. Because remember, the United States was not up there yet. Oklahoma was not a state. Oklahoma was an Indian territory.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Bruce, because you know I was at a tribal function. We had a council meeting outside of Columbus, Georgia, down in Uchee Creek earlier this year.
Yes.
And part of what we did that weekend was to go over to Fort Mitchell on just across the Chattahoochee River in Alabama. And while we were at Fort Mitchell, I took the hike up the hill to see the monument where the plaques lay of Lower Creeks and Upper Creeks who were gathered at Fort Mitchell on one of the many different trails that our people left Alabama and Georgia and parts of Florida.
Removed.
But there were many trails, not just one exodus.
Right.
So groups were gathered at different points in time and in different locations across Creek country. And at this location, at Fort Mitchell, when I went up there to look at those names, mm-hmm. I came across a list of Berry Hills that were on there. And I remember when I called you and I said, Bruce, I'm at Fort Mitchell and I'm looking at Berry Hills. Tell me about your family that you know of. And you came back with some information a little bit later, didn't you?
What that started, I love the internet now because it is so powerful. With that information that you gave me, I typed in One Horse Path Town,
mm-hmm.
and there it was, all my family's names on the list right there. John Dallas Berry Hill, John Berry Hill. All of my direct family is right there. We didn't know where. We knew we came from that area, but we didn't know where it was. That's the beauty of doing this type of research. And that's one of the reasons why I have taken such an interest in doing this family research. Because as each generation goes, the story becomes dimmer. The paperwork becomes less. The story becomes softer. It becomes more difficult. And I'm a firm believer that if you don't know the truth, the next generation will make it up. And they might not tell it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to have a history that is an oral history, because we have to look into each other's eyes to hear the story. You can hear it, but when you look into somebody's eyes, you really hear it. The levels of communication, not just my voice, but the levels of all of my family who are with me, you hear that as well. We are remarkable individuals. We are remarkable beings, because when I tell you a story, you're not just hearing that story. You're hearing all of the stuff that comes with it. All of my history, all of who I am comes with it. That's the beauty. And that's what prompted me. That's what really, understanding that, I was able to see in a vision quest that I began to learn about Indian people, and I began to learn about vision quests. And on a vision quest, I began to realize the power that television offers us. Because let's face it, we all have a TV in our home. I know very few people who do not have a TV. So therefore, as a filmmaker, I have access to your house, to everyone's house. And in by doing that, then I can tell stories and people will listen. Wow, think of that concept. I remember doing a program for Central Virginia's Public Television. They asked me to do a program about Richmond's history. And I thought about it and contacted a very good friend of mine who's a writer, Judith Warrington. And I said, Judith, what are we going to do here? And she said, I don't know, but we've got to do something unique. I said, well, let's do an oral history program, because this was really in my mind. I had been doing several before, but this is one that was really powerful. I proposed to the station, and I had done several programs for them. I had completed a number of programs, several of which had gone national and been very visible. Armstrong and Ellington was what I had just finished, and in my business, you're only as good as your last show. So in making this proposal, I remember Charlie Sidner, who we've become very good friends, and I have a great respect for him. He's also a storyteller and also a producer, director, as well as a station manager, and just a great guy. He gave me this RFP, request for proposal, and he said, I want you to do something that we can use as a pledge piece, something that people would want to pledge to public television, and we'll give them this piece. I thought, gee, what would be more important? You know, Richmonders, Virginians are living in such a wealth of history. I mean, you know, first colonies, Civil War. I mean, we're just immersed in it. But from the 20s through the 60s, there's not a lot of information, and this generation is still with us. So what I proposed was that I would go out with my camera and I would interview people. And I would interview a lot of people, and that I would take that interview and those interviews and put it into a body of work, and out of that body of work, the piece would emerge.
I think that's what Danielle would call an iterative process.
It is an iterative process, and I think this is the Richmond Memories.
Yes.
Program, which was very successful.
Very successful.
Richmond PBS.
The reason why it was so successful. And I don't want to get too far, because there's a little bit more I want to tell you. The reason why it was so successful is a very important principle. We have become so technologically advanced. We are in such a hurry to do things. We have to get to work. We have to get home. We have to go to the market. We have to get home. We have to make... We're in too big a hurry. So what's happened is that the chain has been broken for oral histories between grandmothers and grandchildren. Grandfathers and grandmothers don't take the time. They don't have the time to tell those stories. And so there's a broken link here that we know we need that. And the Richmond Memories is a way to take a community history, right? And to tell it. It's like an electronic campfire. We all sit around the campfire and tell stories about growing up. But these are stories that different communities, the white community, the black community, the Native community, all of us know about each other, but we don't know about each other. Mm-hmm. This is a way to tell stories that will tell us about each other. Keita Menzies, one of the people that I interviewed, said, it's what we don't know about that we act hostile towards.
Well, so in a way, your father reestablished the link in your own
life
to an important community. I have a
sure.
I wanted to ask you about that. How did your father react to your, it sounds like you really searched out your family members. Did he stand at a distance and kind of look at that, or did he participate with you and guide you into reestablishing links to your own family history and to the Creek Nation?
Father, you have to understand, still had this shame of being Indian. A lot of Indian people have it. A lot of the older Indian people. Thank God for the young people who are reaching out to reestablish those links. I love it. That's what it's about. It's reestablishing the links. Father, let me tell you a little story that we'll give. As we began to research, I hired a researcher from Creek Nation, and she went into the National Archives in Houston, where a lot of our family's records are. I have a book, almost a foot thick, of papers that she found. She found our Dawes Rolls, where they inducted us on the Dawes Rolls, the different papers she found where our allotment was, just tremendous amounts of information. My father, I gave this copy to my father, and he was very nice, but you remember this generation. So the young people in the family, my sister's daughter, applied for her CDIB card, Certified Degree of Indian Blood, and got it. It's real. And then we applied for citizenship in the Muscogee Creek Nation. And she was granted by council. She was granted because of the connection. She got all the birth certificates that connected her to her mother, my sister, to my father. We had to get the state, the full face state birth certificates. And my grandfather, who was a Creek Alati. Now there's an unbroken chain by blood. See, it is real. So for us, we began to start researching this even more. And we applied, and each one of us applied. I applied in 94. This was phenomenal because it meant that it was real. That blood is real. I mean, a lot of people talk about it. This is a real thing. My father, to answer your question, was interested. So what I did was, is I took his birth certificate, my grandfather's birth certificate, I filled out the paperwork for Creek Nation, and I got all the birth certificates together. I sent him in a pack and said, sign here, Dad, in a self-addressed to Creek Nation envelope. And I said, sign it and send it. I don't want to hear anything from you. And he did. Mm. Yeah.